This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guests, Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush, have made an amazing movie. It's made its way around this festival circuit for the last year and a half or so. It's called On the Outs, and the directors are here with me, and I'm so thrilled to have them both here. Guys, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tell me how this project got developed, because it's so unusual. I first actually saw a bit of it in Sundance just as a couple of scenes. So if you guys could talk about that a little bit, how it evolved.
Well, it began from an idea. Michael and I were talking. We were really inspired by Liz Garbus's film Girlhood, and both Michael and I and our third partner, Paola Mendoza, all of us had been working with at-risk kids and girls, and we were struck by the fact that we weren't seeing them in film and not narrative film. We had just seen them in Liz Garbus's movie, and we thought, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we get together and do this? Initially, we thought we were going to create a vehicle for Paola because we both really admired her as an actress and wanted to work with her. So we decided to go into a jail and research and meet the kids, and we kind of took it from there.
And Michael, the movie's really simply just about three young women in New Jersey just scrambling to survive, basically.
Yeah, we found when Laurie, myself, and Paola worked in this detention center in Secaucus, New Jersey, we worked with, 40 or so girls who were locked up, many of them there for assault, for battery, for prostitution, for drug use, for runaway. And we were so moved by these stories that we tried to bring, the stories down just to three girls and capture all their experiences within these three girls. And the film is simply, three girls in a life of struggle. One's a drug addict, one's a drug dealer, and one's a runaway. And their lives come together into detention center that we shot in the same detention center that we worked in for 3 months.
I guess it reminded a little bit of some of the old, I don't know if you guys know Shirley Clarke's document movies, they're sort of semi-documentary, semi-real, like Cool World, mm-hmm. where she got real actors and put them in situations very similar to this kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I think what's going to be fascinating for a lot of people who won't know these actresses is how real the movie feels.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was a combination of things. We did go with three actresses to play the lead parts, although we struggled with it. At times we thought, wow, we've got these amazing girls. We had told the girls we worked with in the jail that when they got out, if they stayed in school, they could work with us on the film. And quite a few of them took us up on that. And when we were casting, there was a couple times where we thought, oh, let's just use the girl this is based on. She's so perfect. But the very nature of their lives is so transitory and so chaotic that, you could go a week without hearing from one of these girls. And, of course, that's disaster if you cast somebody who could go AWOL for a week or more. And so we ended up going with real actresses. But we really, really made an effort to cast real people from the block all the time, including a great example of this would be the little girl that plays Paola Mendoza's daughter. She was just turning 3 when she was in the film. And I don't know if you know about 3-year-olds, but you can't tell them, do this now, do that now. They don't do anything on cue. So here was Paola as an actress. She knew what she needed to accomplish and what the beats of the scene were. But she always had to be listening and on her toes and ready to go in a whole different direction because a 3-year-old was running the show. And obviously with adults and with kids that were older, we didn't have quite that level of spontaneity at every minute, but we really did. I think it kept all of our actors in a very alive and alert state working with non-actors in various scenes because we empowered them to just move with it, go with it.
I'll tell you a great story. We were on Location Scout, and we were in this apartment complex, and a mother who had 3 children living on welfare who wanted to give us her apartment for free to use as Marisol's location. And there's this kid in the kitchen. And I start talking to him, and he sounds like he has marbles in his mouth. I'm like, what's in your mouth? And he opens his mouth. He's got 4 vials of cocaine in glass little cases in his mouth. He's like, if the cops come in, I just swallow them, and I can, get rid of them later. So I said, this kid's got to be in the movie. So I told Laurie, I said, we got to use this kid to help mm-hmm. us for research, to help us to figure it out. I said, how do you sell drugs? Where do you put the drugs? So everything looked real. And these kids were on our set every single day, the drug dealers, the kids who were running the block, and they embraced us. They embraced the film because they themselves wanted the story to be told because they felt it was so important that this story gets out there so the young girls don't go into a life of violence, don't go into a life of crime. And they're with us every single day, the whole time the film was made.
And believe me, they let us know if we got something wrong. They
yes.
were right
yes.
there. We had the best peanut gallery. But that's great. I mean, that's ideal because when you're dealing with real lives and when you're dealing with any kind of fictionalized version of real life, it is the details. The details are the big story. The big story comes through the details. There's no way we can get the big story right if we didn't get the little tiny elements, the little textural elements correct. And that's what having people on hand did for us. It was great.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the directors of On the Out, Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush. I've got to ask you this because it feels like it's so dangerous to bring these kids back in who you were talking about how transitory these lives are. It must have been kind of tough for them to have to kind of relive it in some ways, but just playing at it, you know, not actually doing it. Was that tough to get them to sort of revisit that?
They loved it. They loved it. Everybody wants to be a movie star. Everybody wants their moment.
And I think for them, it was just giving them a voice. I mean, no one, the two blocks we shot on in Jersey City, the police said to us from day one, you can't shoot there. We said, why? They said, A, we have police surveillance on one block, and B, the other block is too hot. There's too much violence, too much drug dealing. And we said, this is the place we want to be. We got to be there. So the fact that we came to these blocks and said, we want to work with you guys. We want to include you, not, you know, push you to the side and say, you can't go past that rope because we're making a movie and you guys just, you know, you're in the way. We brought them in. They were like, shoot, we want to be involved. We said, we need a kid to be in this scene. We have 50 kids raising their hand, saying we'll be in the film. And as Laurie said before, they made us get it right. It wasn't even a question of, is this right? They said, no, stop, cut. You got to make sure this is right.
Well, that raises the interesting question, though. How do you sort of keep this drama you try to shape? Because you've got to work this out in terms of actual dramatic conflict and a kind of resolution. And I want to say here, too, that though the movie sounds bleak and is hard to watch it sometimes, it's really optimistic. It's about not giving up. How do you keep on point with these kinds of people who are new to movies but who are also trying to keep you on point?
Well, it was a matter of preparation. I mean, you know, so much of the dialogue of this movie is improvised that I think it's a little bit deceptive because every single moment was scripted in terms of structure. And we had a big whiteboard in our offices, and every night we were going back to structure and story. And each of those We always felt that each of the girls' stories had to work as its own movie and stand up on its own. If you pulled it out, it had to be its own thing. And then it was a question of intercutting them in a way that was organic and didn't feel contrived and felt like inevitable almost. And because we had worked out every beat, and then within each scene, the beats of each scene were worked out on a minor. At that point, you can say to an actor, this is what you're accomplishing at this moment, and you need to get from here to here. Do it in your words. Do it as you would do it on the street. Do it as so. There was a lot of guidance, and then a lot of letting go.
But also to add to that, you know, we spent 6 weeks in a rehearsal room. You know, we rehearsed heavy. You know, we spent
for a 3-week shoot.
You know, for a 3-week shoot, 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, working these scenes. So we brought, Laurie, myself, and Paola brought these scenes to the actors. They would improvise, 2-3 days of the scene. We would shoot it on video. Laurie, as the screenwriter, would then go back, take the video and make it into an incredible, complicated scene. And then we'd bring that script back to the actors. They'd rework the script. Then Laurie would go back and rework the scene. So it was a very intense process of preparation.
Did it help you guys in terms of camera placement too? Because what I was struck by in those handful of scenes I saw before I saw the movie was just how natural the camera feels. I mean, it doesn't feel voyeuristic or anything at all or like a fake. It just feels like the camera's moving around, just happening to capture these young women.
That's really a credit to Mariana Sanchez de Antuniano. That's our cinematographer. She's a tremendous talent. And I say that not just because she has this beautiful visual style, which she does. It's because she starts from story, and that determines what her visual approach is going to be, which always made perfect sense to us. She was early involved in story decisions. And those story decisions, those story conversations ended up impacting the choices of lighting, color, saturation, camera movement. You know, and I love that because I've always felt, that the aesthetics of a film need to follow the content of the film. You can't make those decisions independent of one another. And she really got that. And she was so collaborative with us from such an early stage. And that's why I think you're responding to the fact that the camera moves organically within the story. So if a character is having a disheveled or aggravated internal state, then the camera is going to be aggravated. If it's a fluid moment, a moment of power for Oz, the camera is going to reflect that in its motions as well. So those were choices that were intrinsic to story.
When did that occur to you? Was that happening during the rehearsal, or did you find a lot of these things were just happening as you were also on the floor shooting with the actors too?
The problem would be to go down and say, we're going to make an independent film. Everything's going to be handheld and, you know, documentary and shaky. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the stereotypical independent urban film. And we wanted to go away from that, to really think about this camera as part of the story, not just as what it can do to change emotion or change or make the audience uncomfortable. So we sat for hours and discussed, well, this scene gives off this emotion, so let's have the camera be part of that. Mm-hmm. And to Mariana's credit, this is a one-camera shoot. We had one camera the whole time. It wasn't a three camera. We didn't bring other, you know, no steady cams, no other operators. Mariana was the cinematographer and the operator the whole time.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guests are Michael Skolnick and Laura Silverbush. We're talking about the movie On the Outs. Talk about how excited you must be right now and getting this actually out. You must have felt at some point there was a movie that everybody loved, but everybody was also kind of afraid of picking up too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly it. A sales rep said to a friend of ours at a party one night that, you know, Skolnick and Silverbush and Mendoza are persistent. And I think it's somewhat of an understatement, because no one thought this film would sell. No one thought this film had an audience that was a commercial audience. Everyone thought it'd be a good film festival film. And when the Film Forum asked us to open the film this summer in New York, we agreed and we were honored to be there. But we felt this was our chance to prove to the distribution world that we have an audience. And boy, did they show up. We were number two in the country per screen box office our opening week with not a dollar for advertising. And then the distributor said, wow, there is an audience for this. And now we're seeing, as we're opening in Los Angeles and New York and D.C. and Philly and Miami and across the country, people are responding. People are responding incredibly well. But a film like this, Elvis, was independent as they come. We didn't have an executive producer who's a celebrity. We didn't have, you know, any big sales rep behind us from the beginning. We had the three of us with a vision, and we wanted to make this film no matter what.
I want you to talk a little bit, too, about how you happened to put together the money to make something like this, because it doesn't operate in any of the realms that we think as being independent films. You were saying it doesn't have the attachments of celebrity to get it noticed. It doesn't mm-hmm. also – it's also not shot like an archetypal independent film mm-hmm. because you sort of let the material dictate the kind of decisions you made mm-hmm. as making the film, yeah. That must have in some ways helped you dictate how you want to get it out too, didn't it?
I got to be honest with you, Elvis. We finished the film the night before we got on the plane to Toronto. We went to Toronto. We played to packed houses and people. And Christophe from Berlin, the Berlinale, came up to us and said, this movie's got to play at Berlin. Boom, we were heading to Berlin. We were desperate to get our sound done in time for Berlin. Then we're at Berlin. Like, everything sort of just led to the next thing. At Berlin, we got a phone call that Fabrique, our French distributor, was interested. They wanted to go ahead and sign a deal with us. So we've just been saying sort of, yes, let's figure it out as we go. We didn't start with this mentality of, how are we going to sell this film? We started with let's just dive in. And at every level, we've just been diving in. What we haven't been willing to do is to agree when people say, oh, it's just not commercial. It's just not, because what we saw when we opened at the Film Forum this summer, the Film Forum was really surprised. They were seeing audiences of color. They were seeing audiences, kids 25 and under. Not an audience that Film Forum is used to attracting. And these kids came out in force. And actually, we chose to partner with Cornerstone Marketing. Cornerstone Promotions is a company that is the largest urban marketing promotions company. And they are known for their reach to kids and their ability to find the thing that kids are going to jump on. And they brought us on to be one of their first films ever in their film side. So I think we always believed that this could go well beyond the traditional art house arena. And we made the decision that we would try to pursue that one way or the other.
Because I find myself thinking about movies that really sort of attempt to do an artificial version of this. Mm-hmm. You guys must have been a little sort of disappointed seeing these sort of things come out and just sort of like stumble. You think, we've got the real thing here, and they're all afraid of it.
I think for us, our biggest stamp of approval is from the kids. It's from a young person saying, we had a 14-year-old girl come up to us and say, my sister's addicted to drugs. I don't know what to do. We said, bring her to the film. Come, you know, she came to the film. We took her out for ice cream, her and her sister afterwards, and both of them were in tears and saying, the kid wants to go to rehab. That, to me, is where the approval comes from. And it's not from the studio saying, oh, wow, you guys are great filmmakers. Let's make you another film. It's from that the young people say, this is our lives on screen. And now, if we can give it to them and say, use it, you know, for empowerment, as you said, there's optimism here, you know, that you got to keep fighting in order to survive, and give it to them for empowerment, then hopefully we'll succeed with them. If the audiences show up, we'll be thrilled. But the young people come and are inspired or moved by the film, I think we're even more thrilled.
We'll take a break here. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm talking to Laurie Silverbush and Michael Skolnick. Their film is On the Outs. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. The amazing film we're talking about is On the Outs. Its directors Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush are here. I was asking a question. I got a little sidetracked about how the money came together to make this, because I think this movie should serve as kind of an object lesson to people who are constantly rebuffed, because what it strikes me as, this movie, is the kind of movie that when it gets out there, it becomes the sort of thing that becomes part of the grammar of independent film. And mm-hmm. I wonder how you guys got the money together to do it. Because I want you to talk a little bit how long a process that was.
Well, we called up a lot of rich people. I mean, it sounds silly, but Michael and I got on the phone with anybody that we knew who we thought would be interested in either the subject matter or just financing independent film. You know, Michael and I had both had a certain amount of success and awards and various things that made us look credible, at least to people outside the film industry. And, you know, we did it the way you would do it if you were starting any kind of small business. We put up a business, we created a business plan. Now, I think people in the industry understand that a business plan really doesn't mean much because there's no way to predict if a movie's going to make money or not. But it certainly means a lot if you're going to Wall Street people. They want to see a clear cut, you know, they want pie charts. They really do. So we gave them some pie charts. And we reached out to people who over the years had said, hey, you know, I'm interested in what you're doing. Let me know if I can ever help. And I think we had filed away a little list, both of us, of people who had put that energy out to us. And we were really shameless about picking up the phone. And we really made a decision to go for as little money as we could possibly take to make this movie really well. And that's, you know, some of the people that we went to, the amount of money we got from them was not that much. They would have given us more, maybe even considerably more. But we wanted the freedom to be as risky as possible at all times. And to us, that meant we didn't want to take anyone's 401ks. We didn't take our parents' retirement. We went for people for whom it was mad money. And then we took so little of it that if we lost it egregiously, they'd still talk to us and be okay. And that was an absolute choice.
I think also we also presented ourselves in a way that we were going to make this film no matter what. And I think that's important for any, you know, young filmmaker out there who's trying to make an independent film. A lot of the times we get so caught up in just dreams and language and treatments and scripts. And Laurie and I said, no matter what we're going to do, we're making this film November 1st. Either you're in the game or you're not in the game. Either you give us money or you don't, but we're making this film. And to them, that assured them that this was real, that it wasn't just, you know, Michael and Laurie's pipe dream.
So you basically make it sound this train's going to leave the station. Do you want to be on it or not?
Exactly. I mean, when we started production, Elvis, we had $10,000 in the bank. It wasn't like we had, you know, we were bankrolled and said, oh, we're ready to go. We had 10 grand in the bank, and we had people who said they were going to give us money. But once the train started to move, people said, oh, it's real. They're making it. Let's write a check.
We were between takes on the cell phone calling people up saying, just remember that movie we told you that you said you wanted it? Well, actually, in 10 minutes, we're shooting another scene. So chance that check could come through today, and they're like, oh yeah, sure, because they'd been on a cruise or whatever, you know, and they came through. It was stressful, though. I'm not going to lie to you. It's stressful. It's stressful to start production without all the money for your bankroll, for your payroll. You know, that's a little stressful. But again, I think it was that energy of, and I credit Michael largely with that because, you know, he has that incredible comfort level with risk that is essential in this kind of situation, you know, because you have to, it's the jumping in that's hard. That's the hard part. Once you're in, you're in.
It strikes me, too, as being fascinating because you've got this sort of thing where it's this small a project. You're not going to have anybody to try to come in and take control of it. It still gets to be your film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for us, as Louis discussed before the break, we never really thought about all of this. We never really said, oh, we're going to go to – our plan is to go to Toronto and then go to Sundance and then go to Berlin. Like when we got to Toronto and there we were with Hotel Rwanda and Ray and all these and all these big stars, we're like, holy cow, how did we get to this place and 600 people coming to see your film? We never realized that our film would play at a film festival, that it would play to reviewers, that New York Times would write a review about it. Like, it never crossed our mind. And maybe that was a little bit of our naivete, but I think it also pushed us to stay true to what we wanted to do.
It's The Treatment. My guests are Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush. They're the directors of the new film, On the Outs. One of the things that really fascinates me about the movie, and I've talked to you a little bit about this, Laurie, is just the way you cast the faces. Because generally, at some point in an indie film, no matter how minimal the budget, there's something that sort of screams, we finally got a chance to make a movie. So it's like a ridiculously extended like take or something tricky done with the camera work. And this movie is really just about these women, these incredible faces that they have. And that must have been key to try to cast people who we would want to look at.
Mm. Mm. That's a a great point. I think for the three leads, for Annie, Judy, and Paola, there was something about the three of them that was just magnetic. I mean, they were just – you just wanted to be around them. I think
was that because you talked about making the decision to not use real-life people but to use actresses. As you were casting, did you just know you had to find people who you weren't paying as much attention to as you would the real-life protagonists?
Definitely, but I think it came down to, you know, when we were in the jail with the girls, we fell in love head over heels with these girls. They were so beautiful and courageous and messed up and twisted and funny. And they, you know, and so we grew that. We started to feel that way about the kids themselves. We literally couldn't wait to see their faces when we would show up, having just seen them the day before. It's like seeing your own kid. You get so excited. And I think what happened was we didn't say we want to cast gorgeous lookers that people will just know. It was more like we want to find people that audiences of any stripe will watch these kids and feel like, oh, this is my kid.
Yeah,
this
kid. But they are gorgeous.
Yeah, well, they're gorgeous. But
I think also that they're real. If you look at, you know, Judy comes from the Lower East Side of New York City. Andy comes from the Bronx. Paola's, you know, from L.A. was gangbanging at 13 years old. These young actresses brought their own lives to the rehearsal room. Dominic Colon, who plays Chewy, from the Bronx, grew up in the streets of New York. And they brought so much to the table that, to be frank, as two white filmmakers who didn't grow up in these communities, we couldn't bring. I'm not going to lie and say, oh, I could bring the inner city experience to the table. I couldn't. Lori couldn't. So we brought actors together, not only that they were good looking and incredibly talented, but they had real lives to bring to the table. And they added. Every single day we got into that rehearsal room, they added to what we had.
Mm, definitely. They enriched it. But I do want to speak to one thing you're saying, Elvis, about the casting. I feel really strongly that when you're casting, you're not casting based on these external values. You have to sort of isolate the core essence of the character that you're trying to cast, and then you need to cast according to that essence. So somebody like Judy Marte, who is actually very feminine, very female, very flirtatious, very goofy.
And it worked in the movies like this before, where they were kind of organic experiences between Five Feet High and Rising and Raising
Exactly.
Victor Vargas.
And the thing about when you see her in playing Juicy Judy in Raising Victor Vargas, she's the hot chick. She's the girl that all the boys want. And it's 180 degrees different than the character she plays in Oz. But if you watch that performance, there's an inner core steel to Juicy Judy. There is a stillness and a steel there. Nobody gets anything past that girl. And that's Oz. So Oz, the rest is technique. The rest is, you know, let's teach her how to walk. But that core essence, that's what you're casting for.
I guess we should say again, too, the movie is on the out. Just directors Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush are here to talk about it. This has been such a sort of an organic experience. Each step is sort of taking on a life of its own. It's got to make you a little nervous about going on to do that movie. And eventually, I don't know if these are your ambitions or not, you're going to do movies that are going to have actors who are going to bring different kinds of baggage and different expectations. You're not going to have another Crucible like this again, where this thing is sort of being born for you with the actors right in front of you. I mean, people who are going to be thrilled to be a part of the process because they're building something with you. Are you a little nervous about what the future may hold given the kinds of movies that get made?
To me, it's the process. And I make mostly documentary films. So I just came back from Haiti last night. I was in Haiti for 3 days with, you know, 15 kids with M16s. And at that moment, it's thrilling. When you get back to the hotel, you're like, why was I there? But I think at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, why are you doing this? And for those young filmmakers who are listening, I think you have to define what success is for you from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And as Laurie said, for this film, we defined it very clearly. It was not about the big awards or the film festivals or the distribution. It was about making mm-hmm. something real and organic and that kids could respond to. And if it went beyond that, then it's icing on the cake. And I've defined personally what success is for me. And sure, you're fearful because now you're entering waters where, you know, I go to L.A. and they say, well, you made this independent film, which is small. Now you can make an $18 million film. You know, you can flip cars in the Fast and Furious 7. And I'm thinking to myself, I can? Like, I can really do that? I made one small little film. But, you know, once you make that one film, I guess now everyone believes you can do it. But I think as long as you keep your success in order and keep your career in order, hopefully I'll stay in one piece. Or we both will stay in one piece.
But I'm guessing because just seeing the movie the number of times I've seen it, it really is. I'm just sort of struck how it's about people wrestling with fears and just sort of saying, well, I don't have any choice. You know, this is the life I have. Either I stay in the house or I don't.
Yes and no, Elvis, because I actually think that the girls that we portray, I always sort of felt like I want to – if you took a map of Jersey City and you pushed down in one spot. You know, you put your thumb down. I wanted to lift up my thumb and what's underneath it, and I want to see that. Like, I wanted it to not be about big issues that are being faced by this heroic kid. It wasn't that. I wanted it to be about just the life. I just wanted them living life. And I wanted it presented without judgment and without agenda, just living their lives. And then from that comes everything else that's very big and very meaningful to me and frankly, fairly politically motivated. But the thing is that it was always about, I think it takes skill and confidence to be simple. And I think we worked very hard to do stuff in a simple and clean way. And by that, I mean, we didn't want to say, look, Ma, look what we can do. Here's a camera. Let's do this. We wanted to let the story and the characters drive the filmmaking, and we aimed for a clean storytelling. And I don't know if I'm making any sense, but in doing that, I felt that the truths had to emerge, the bigger truths. So it wasn't like we went in to say, okay, we're going to make a movie about fear. No, we wanted to make a movie about
But that's part of it too, though. I mean, I'm not saying it's like the preeminent thing in the movie, but it's one of the things that you can't see to not notice.
And I think a lot of young people, rich, poor, black, white, Latino, what have you, I think it comes down to opportunity, right? So when you have lack of opportunity, of course you're fearful. When as Laurie said, you put your thumb down and you pick it up in Jersey City and you have a kid who all they know is four blocks. All they know is from, you know, 18th Street to 22nd Street, and that's their world. And here and on the outs, New York City is this metropolis right across the river. And there's a Statue of Liberty with her back turned to Jersey City. So all they know is this four blocks. Of course they're fearful. Of course they're fearful to step out of their element. That's why we have this scene where Oz takes her little brother to Times Square, and it's like they're in Paris. But yet it's 15 minutes away. It's as if, you know, they were a tourist in the middle of, you know, in the middle of the Eiffel Tower.
And that was very much if you had to say we were making any kind of a statement at all, I think that, you know, poverty is one of those things that is so limiting. And ultimately, the greatest and most tragic effect is the poverty of human imagination. I mean, it ends up withering your world. And the world of these girls was very, very, very small. And, you know, when we would say to them, well, we're from New York City or we're going to make a movie, you could see it wasn't even disbelief. It was a blank. Like there was no visualizing what we said. It was until we were doing what we were doing that they got it.
That's probably a great place. I want to thank you guys for coming. The movie is On the Outs. It's directors. Thanks again, Michael Skolnick and Laurie Silverbush. It's great to see that you guys are as excited about this movie now when I first met you. And I'm just thrilled that you could come and talk about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elvis. And as we are a small film, I have to plug our website. So go to ontheouts.com to check out what the film was playing this week.
I have to plug our technical people. Our technical director in Los Angeles at KCRW is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Washi Porchik at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holt is the producer. I'll plug myself. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.